Thank you, Murray. It's really an honor to be here with our three distinguished guests and also colleagues from so far across campus and also from UC Berkeley. And I especially would like to thank Murray Gardner for his tremendous vision and generosity for putting on this conference. And thank you, Anita, for all your work, time and energy in the organizational aspects. So plant disease cause devastating effects. And this is a pathogen that is the causal agent of the Irish potato famine. So this is a 4-day time-lapse video taken by Remco Stan, University of Dundee. Now, this pathogen infected the potato crop about 150 years ago in Ireland, as our distinguished guest Luke is very familiar with, and really changed the course of history. 1 million people died of starvation, and 1 million more emigrated. Among those was the great-great-great-grandfather of President Obama. So this devastating agricultural problem really launched the first studies of the basis of disease. And there was a plant pathologist, Anton DeBerry, that demonstrated for the first time that microbes caused infection in his studies of rust and smut fungi on cereals. Up to this point, it was thought that diseases of plants and animals were acts of God. In 1862, Pasteur showed that when you make beer in sterile conditions, that there was bacterial contamination that could cause what he caused diseases. And he was familiar with Anton DeBerry's work, and he hypothesized that animals too would be infected by microbes. And as Bruce said, in 1876, Koch showed that indeed animal diseases were also caused by microorganisms. So this launched really the beginning of modern agriculture. In 1905, Roland Biffen, a British geneticist, showed that genes can be moved between different varieties. And in particular, he showed that resistance could be moved from a wheat variety that was resistant to another variety that was susceptible. Today, virtually everything we eat carries resistance genes. And H.H. Flohr in 1946 began to study both the host genetics and the pathogen genetics. And this work inspired a whole new generation of plant pathologists. So the key questions in innate immunity in the 1990s when I began this work are, what are the receptors that mediate infection? What microbial signatures are recognized by these receptors? And what are the signaling components activated upon recognition? And if I had been a better graduate student, I would have read the literature and realized that the animal researchers were going after the same major questions. So in the plant world, this discovery of the receptors that mediated infection occurred in the early 1990s, and there was an avalanche of discoveries. It was a very exciting time. And here I show some of the early sensors of microbial infection: tomato CF9, rice XA21, tomato PTO, and a whole class of very large intracellular sensors called NDS-LRR proteins. Now, these intracellular receptors perceive very highly variable pathogen effectors, and these effectors are secreted directly into the cell via bacterial type 3 secretion systems. This is a very important area of research, but I won't talk about it today. I'll be talking about the class of receptors that recognize conserved microbial signatures. And I want to acknowledge the tremendous team of researchers all over the world that isolated these first receptors, and it's very important to make the point that most of these scientists are at UC Davis and UC Berkeley. So And for Murray, I will mention that one of these receptors was cloned in Hilgard Hall and one in Hutchison Hall. So your father would be very pleased to know that. Now, I study bacterial blight of rice. This is a gram-negative bacteria called Xanthomonas oryzae, Pathobar oryzae. Xanthomonas species infect virtually all crop plants, so it's a very important disease of plants. And here you can see that it forms a yellow pigment in media. And this shows you the infection right here. After several days, the bacteria will ooze out of the rice leaf. Now, this is a serious disease in Africa and Asia, and it can cause crop losses from up to 50%. Now, over the years, there have been resistance varieties identified. So there's something like 80,000 different rice varieties that have been stored at the International Rice Research Institute. Much of this genetic diversity remains unexplored. So it's a really great resource for many of you that are interested in plant genetics. But there was one rice species, it's a wild rice species, Oryzologus dominata, that is from Mali in Africa, West Africa. And this was a very unusual variety because it had broad spectrum resistance to virtually all strains of the pathogen that had been identified. This is Gurdip Kush. He was a graduate student here with Ledyard Stebbins and also a student postdoc with Charlie Rick, a famous geneticist here at UC Davis. And he did a lot of his work, most of his career at the International Rice Research Institute. There he learned about this wild species of rice, and he launched a breeding program to begin to introduce this locus, which he named XA21, into modern rice varieties. Gurdip Kush is back here at UC Davis, and he was awarded the World Food Prize for his work in Green Revolution rice in 1996. So I met Professor Kush in 1990 in the Philippines at a meeting at URI, and he, at that point, provided me the seed of the XA21 rice. So my laboratory isolated XA21 through a map-based cloning approach, and we were trying to answer a pretty simple question, which was, well, what is the XA21 locus? Is it a cluster of tightly linked genes? And this was certainly a possibility because perhaps there were genes right next to each other on the chromosome that recognized different strains of the bacteria. Or was it a single gene that recognized the conserved microbial signature that was present in all strains of the bacteria? And we found that it was indeed a single gene, and this shows you the typical way we do our experiments. This is a susceptible variety, and we take scissors, we dip them in bacteria, we clip the ends of the leaves, and after 10 days, we see these long, long lesions. Now, when we took our candidate gene and transformed it into this rice line and then inoculated, we see the plants were completely resistant to disease. So that demonstrated that we had isolated the gene of interest, XA21. So what is XA21? It was a receptor kinase, and this was also very exciting at that time. There had been not a good evidence that receptor kinases even existed in plants, although there was one important report suggesting that. And it was, the structure immediately gave us a model. It looked like this extracellular leucine-rich repeat domain would engage the microbial molecule, which we now call AX21, a transmembrane domain, and an intracellular kinase, and the kinase domain then would signal the downstream signaling response. I still remember the day when the Toll paper came out. We all remember the fly, and I remember my colleague calling me up excitingly, "You have to look at this paper." And indeed, it was dramatically remarkable similar structure with the extracellular leucine-rich repeat, but it had this TIR domain, and as we know, TLR4 had the same structure. And we also have known that these associate kinases via adaptor proteins, and more recently, we've shown that all these kinases belong to a small subclass of kinases called non-arginine aspartate kinases. Normally, most kinases in plant and animal genomes carry an arginine, whereas XA21 has a cysteine in this place. So in humans, only about 10% of the kinome belongs to this non-RD class, and in rice it's about 20%. So we now know that this non-RD motif is typical of kinases that are involved in the initial response to infection. And I wanted to mention the work of Barbara Baker of UC Berkeley. She had isolated this MBSLR protein that had the TIR motif. And so at this point, in the early 1990s, we knew that it seemed that plants and animals responded to infection in similar ways. And if there was any doubt, that was confirmed shortly thereafter with the discovery of FLS2, Arabidopsis from Thomas Fuller's lab, and he was able to show FLS2 responded to flagellin. And TLR5 then in animals sort of completed this circuit, which TLR5 also responded to flagellin. So I want to tell you today a little bit about AX21, because all these, except for TOL, but TLR4, FLS2, and TLR5 recognize these conserved microbial signature molecules. And we have, for many years, been interested in identifying AX21, and this turns out to be the greatest puzzle of my career. So this is the team. There's been many more people that have worked on it, but the initial team trying to isolate this molecule that we've called AX21, activator of XA21-mediated immunity. So what is this molecule? We use two approaches. We use a classical genetic approach, either by mutagenesis of a wild-type Xanthomonas strain or complementation of a mutant strain, and the goal was to identify RAX genes. These are genes required for activation of XA21-mediated immunity. And the other approach was to purify and characterize AX21 from bacterial supernatants. So the genetic approach led us to a small operon, the RAX-STAB operon. And we at first were slightly disappointed. We just wanted to get to the gene and, you know, be done with it. But instead, we ended up with these proteins, and RAX-A and B form components of a type 1 secretion system. This type of system sends molecules from inside the cell to outside the cell. RAX-A and RAX-B work together with an outer membrane protein called RAX-C. And mutations in any of these genes, any of these four genes, completely destroyed AX21 activity. So all four of these genes were required. RAX-ST encoded a putative sulfyl transferase, and at first we really did not know what to do with that. So we developed a model. I should say quickly that RAX-B, which is this intermembrane transporter, fell into a class of transporters that carry a conserved proteolytic domain. And that proteolytic domain was known to cleave N-terminal sequences from small proteins. So our model then is that there was some small protein in the cell, and that would be cleaved by RAX-B, and there you go. It goes outside the cell, and there it is recognized by the XA21 receptor, leading to a plant defense response. So we carried out a biochemical assay. I won't go into the assay, but someone, Lee, in the lab developed that assay, and we were able to identify from HPLC fractions a protein that could trigger XA21-mediated immunity. And this was immediately very interesting to us. It carried this N-terminal leader, as we predicted, and it carried a tyrosine. And when we made mutations in this gene, the bacterial strains lost AX21 activity, so we knew we had the right gene. The next question was, well, what is this tyrosine? And we thought, well, perhaps this tyrosine is a substrate for RAX-ST, which was in the same operon as the secretion components. Now, we were unsure at first. prokaryotes had not previously been demonstrated. But we went ahead and purified recombinant rats, team carried out by a chemical approach. And I want to mention also that we had identified two other genes that were required for AX21 activity. And these two genes were important for the synthesis of phosphoadenosine phosphosulfate. Now, PAPS is a substrate for sulfur transferases. So Sang-wook Han in the lab used a peptide, AX21 peptide, with the tyrosine 22, added RAX-ST, PAPS, and he was able to show that he obtained sulfated AX21. So AX21 is a substrate of RAX-ST, and when he made mutations in that conserved tyrosine to alanine, the sulfation no longer occurred. So this is very interesting. It's known that sulfation turns out to be very important for modulating receptor ligand interactions, extracellular interactions. And a classic example from agriculture is Cyanorhizobium melaloti, which is critical for nitrogen fixation. This bacteria fixes nodules on its host. And sulfation of this nod factor is required for specific recognition by its host. If the nod factor is not sulfated, the host no longer recognizes it and nodules do not form. This is also very interesting. You start looking in the literature, it turns out that the CCR5 coreceptor is key to recognition of the GP120 subunit of the HIV envelope glycoprotein. Now, when this CCR5 is absent, HIV can no longer bind, and in fact, that small segment of the human population that lacks CCR5 are immune to HIV. So we then tested if AX21 could directly trigger XA21-mediated immunity. We synthesized three peptides, one that's sulfated on the tyrosine, one that's non-sulfated, and an alanine mutation. And we carried out our assays, and essentially what we do is we take leaves, we clip off the end of the leaf, we dip it in the peptide, or a supernatant, we wait a few hours, and then we inoculate with a strain that can usually cause disease. And when we pre-treat with a supernatant from a wild-type bacterial strain, 5 hours later inoculate with this mutant strain, you can see that the supernatant induces robust resistance. When we inoculate with pre-treat with water, the plants are completely susceptible. But when we take the small sulfated peptide, it induces a robust immune response, and the two control peptides do not induce this response. So this indicated that we could take a sulfated peptide to trigger immunity. And Changjin Park in the laboratory used a co-immunoprecipitation approach to show that that XA21 itself binds the sulfated peptide. So sulfyl tyrosine is critical for this receptor ligand interaction. So what is this thing? So AX21, as predicted, it's a conserved microbial signature. It's highly conserved in all Xanthomonas species. It's present in Xylella fastidiosa, the causal agent of Pierce's disease, which Max Gardner also worked on. And it's also present in the human pathogen Stenotrophomonas maltophilia, which is an important, can cause important infections in hospital patients. So this shows you Xylella, and this is Stenotrophomonas. So this thing is highly conserved. Biologists think, okay, if it's conserved, it's important. And so the question is, well, what does it do? Why does the bacteria maintain this molecule that allows it to be recognized by the host? So we looked at the literature. By then, I was an established professor, so I knew I better start reading the literature. And I found that in gram-positive bacteria, type 1 secreted peptides are known to function in quorum sensing. And we started to look, I wanted to explain to you what quorum sensing is. So quorum sensing is this really fabulous process where single-cell bacteria, they will emit small molecules. And at low concentrations, it has no effects, no change in gene expression. But when the bacteria reach a quorum, a high density, receptors present on the bacterial surface will bind to these molecules and trigger a dramatic change in gene expression. And this is an image from a classic paper by Bonnie Bassler's lab showing that as you increase in cell density, you get these dramatic changes in gene expression. So there have been two classes of quorum sensing factor. Then the gram-negative bacteria, acyl homostearin lactone autoinducers, had been characterized in Fibrio and Pseudomonas aeruginosa, mainly by Bonnie Bassler's lab. And also in Xanthomonas, there was a diffusible signal factor that had been characterized. There, at the time, seemed to be a very strong division between gram-negative and gram-positive bacteria. Gram-positive bacteria were known to use these oligopeptide autoinducers, or small peptides. So we were quite puzzled at first. We had a gram-negative bacteria, but at the time we believed it was a small peptide. All the evidence pointed to that. There was a paper that came out This is what I wanted to tell you. Peptide-mediated quorum sensing in gram-negative bacteria had been reported. So there was some evidence that gram-negative bacteria produced small peptides. So we carried out a classic experiment. We took our mutant lactin AX21, we compared it to the wild type, and we looked at different cell densities, and indeed, AX21 controlled expression of nearly 500 genes. So then we wanted to prove that AX21 was indeed a quorum sensing factor, and over the years we had shown that in the wild type strain we had expression of the RAX genes. So RAX-T is highly expressed in the wild type strain, but it's not expressed in the mutant. And we also had identified that the other RAX genes were also rated by AX21. So we used this as a marker, and Sango Khan in the lab purified recombinant AX21 and added it back. So simply exogenous addition to the bacterial mutant strain, and you can see it restored RAX-ST expression, and this is at high density. This is dose-dependent, so higher amounts of recombinant AX21 induces higher levels of expression. So this indicated that AX21 protein is indeed a quorum-sensing factor. So what does it do? So some of the genes that were regulated by AX21 were involved in a process called biofilm formation. And this is a biofilm is an aggregate of microorganism in which cells adhere to each other and or to a cell surface. And this shows you a solid surface here, and you can see the bacteria begin to adhere, and then they move from these unicellular organisms to these multicellular structures, and this is encased in an exopolysaccharide. And in the mature biofilm, eventually the bacteria will move to new sites, they'll open up and move to new sites. Biofilms have become very important in plants and animals. They're thought to be involved in nearly 80% of infections of plants and animals. And that's one reason bacteria are sometimes hard to control with antibiotics, because these biofilms are very resistant to antibiotics. So Frank White, who is a colleague in Kansas, had taken these incredible images of Xanthomonas infecting xylem cells. What you see here are bacteria packed very thickly into the cells. In fact, they look exactly like a biofilm. We then went ahead and took our AX21 mutants, and we were able to show that the AX21 mutants no longer formed biofilms in plate assays, and we showed at low density assays AX21 mutants could no longer infect rice plants. So this indicated that AX21 was important in virulence. So I have a few more slides, but there we go. Okay, so I want to just recap a little bit what I just told you. So AX21 is conserved. It's conserved because it's important for cell-cell communication. And it has this important activity inside the cell. It's sulfated by RAGS-ST. And the sulfated AX21 then is the leader is cleaved. AX21 is secreted outside the cell where it interacts with the XA21 receptor. But if AX21 is an important sensing factor, it must also interact with the bacterial receptor. And we've recently used genetic evidence to identify the candidate receptor, which we named RAX-H. And RAX-H is a histidine kinase. And these are receptors, bacterial receptors, that sense extracellular changes, and they autophosphorylate upon binding to a histidine, and then they can transfer that phosphate to a response regulator. In this case, we have identified RAX-R as the cognate response regulator for RAX-H. And we've shown that RAX-R then can bind to all the promoters of these AX21 regulated genes. So XOO cells communicate with each other using XA21 and the RAX-H receptor. So they're busily talking to each other, plotting their strategy, planning to attack. Now, this is very similar to what was going on in World War II. During World War II, the Germans had developed these coded messages using the Enigma machine. And they were encrypting their messages, and they were sending messages back and forth. But the British now had figured out a way to intercept these communication signals. And that, many people believe the work of Alan Turing and his colleagues really hastened the end of the Allied victory. And so I think of RICE as Alan Turing. Basically, it's the receptor for intercepting communications and leading to immune response. And I just diagram that again here. So here's the RICE leaf. And what you see then inside the xylem of the RICE plant, the bacteria then will try to infect the parenchyma cells. They'll start to secrete these peptides to each other. Then early, very, very early in the infection, XA21 recognizes this molecule and activates the defense response. So I wanted to just end my talk with two more points, where we are with the downstream components, and also how we're harnessing the possibilities of this knowledge. So this is a breakfast of a family in Mali. They're having rice for breakfast. In fact, they're having rice three times a day. And the long-term hope of this research is to develop new varieties that can be useful for farmers in Asia and Africa. So we have, as many of you over the years, developed these massive data sets. So we carry out these proteomics data sets. We've developed an interactome that I'm not going to show you today. We have gene expression profiling data. We're starting to have metabolomics data. But what we've been doing in the lab is somebody will develop a protein interaction. You'll look at a protein. Oh, you know, I kind of like that one. They have a good feeling for the protein. And then they'll work on it. And sometimes it turns out to be quite interesting, but other times not so interesting. And so we've been looking for ways that we can use a more advanced statistical approach to identifying genes that are going to be most interesting for the defense response. And so we sought out Edwin Marcotte at the University of Texas, Austin, to collaborate on this project, as well as In-Suk Lee. And they have developed these probabilistic functional gene networks for many organisms. And they set up a network for rice called RiceNet. And so what they do is they don't only look at what's known about rice, but they look at Arabidopsis. They will look at yeast. They will look at flies. And so since we now know that innate immune pathways are so very highly conserved, we can gain a lot from this type of comparative analysis. So they analyzed 50 million data points from 5 different species and generated RiceNet. This is RiceNet. This is what it looks like. It's a linkage of 45% of the estimated 41,000 rice genes. So each of these lines is a connection between two genes. So not necessarily a protein interaction connection, but it could be just a genetic connection, a literature connection. So this this image is made up of many different types of underlying data. So what can we do this with this? We can query the network. And the way we query the network is we take genes that we know are involved in the innate immune response, and we've genetically characterized about 17 of those, and we use those to query the network, and then RiceNet will tell you what other genes are predicted to be involved in that response. And so here you see in red some of the genes that we've shown to be critically important for this response. And then in green are those genes that are now predicted to also be involved in the response. And in blue are the lines connecting these. So this is still quite a handful, especially if you're a rice geneticist. It's impossible right now in a short lifetime to knock out 800 genes. So we carried out several other prioritization approaches that I won't have time to talk about, but involve pairwise interactions, yeast hybrid interactions. And we were able then to identify three new regulators of SH21-mediated immunity. One of our criteria was to identify genes that had not been shown to be involved in immunity in either plants or animals. And we then would overexpress these genes or silence these genes and carry out infection assays in rice. And I'll show you three of these genes. And ROCS1 is a thiamine pyrophosphokinase gene. We don't know where it's located yet in the pathway, but it's also been implicated in some types of human encephalopathy. And ROCS2 is a NOL1, NOT2, Sun family domain-containing gene. It's been implicated in a developmental disorder. And ROCS3 is involved in a MUC-type protein, which has been shown to be important for tumor proliferation. So this kind of research brings together new knowledge about the plant immune response, but also we believe that we can use this knowledge to identify genes that also may be important for the fly or mouse responses. So this is our current model for SH21-mediated immunity. So I mentioned that SH21 has this non-RD kinase. The mechanism of activation of non-RD kinases is not well understood at all. So we're very interested in trying to understand how these important kinases are activated. And we've begun to make some progress. So we know that SH21 is synthesized in the ER, and that it interacts with SH21-associated kinase 1, which is a receptor kinase. For those of you that work in Arabidopsis, this is analogous to BAC1 in Arabidopsis that associates with FLS2. And Shui Chen at the lab showed that SH21 interacts with an ATPase called XB24. Now, XB24 promotes autophosphorylation of XB21. Autophosphorylated XA21 is inactive, so it's a little bit counterintuitive to how we normally think about the activation of kinases. When XA21 binds AX21, the in vivo interaction between XB24 and XA21 is removed, and that allows for the defense response. XA21 signals through XB3, which is a ring finger ubiquitin ligase. We believe it's analogous to TRAF6. In the human innate immune response. There is ample suggestions that there's a MAPK kinase involved, and we know that XA21 signals through a subgroup of working transcription factors. And so for animal biologists, animals do not have working transcription factors. Plants do not have NF-kappa-B transcription factors. So we can think about these working transcription factors as the animal counterparts to NF-kappa-B. Now, Chongjin Park in the lab has recently made an interesting discovery that when AX21 binds XA21, that XA21 is cleaved, and the kinase domain moves into the nucleus and binds to these working transcription factors. And we're very interested in following up on this. There are reports that IRAK1 also binds the NF-kappa-B elements in the nucleus. So this nuclear translocation may be a very important way that these non-RD kinases function. And so that leads to the immune response. This immune response has to be carefully negatively regulated, and we've identified a phosphatase that turns off this pathway. So harnessing the possibilities. So when the plant biologists many years ago started isolating these genes, right away the idea was, well, let's create chimeric receptors. So instead of only recognizing xanthomonas and rice, we can create transgenic wheat that are resistant to stem rust. So these were really the ideas. But back then, it was very slow. Many of these, I won't even go into detail, but many of these procedures that were needed were very slow. However, just in the last few years, there's been sort of a renaissance of interest in engineering these receptors. And there's a group in Japan that used a chitin binding domain and fused that to the XA21 intracellular kinase domain. And they took that genetically engineered receptor, they transferred it to rice, and they were able to show now that this rice plant confers resistance to rice blast. This is a fungal pathogen that's considered one of the worst diseases in the world because it can infect virtually all rice crops. There's also been some exciting work from Cyril Zipfel's lab showing that the EFR receptor is very similar to XA21, that it can be moved from Arabidopsis to tobacco and tomato and can confer resistance to serious diseases of those species as well. We're very interested in starting to look at some other problems, and we are starting a project looking at banana xanthomonas wilt. So most of you probably know that rice, wheat, and maize are the world's most important food staples, but what's less well known is that banana is the fourth staple. It's an important staple food for people in Africa. 100 million people in East Africa rely on banana for sustenance. There's a disease that has been spreading like wildflower throughout Eastern Africa called banana xanthomonas wilt, and it infects virtually all banana varieties. There's no known method to control this disease, and it's very, very difficult to breed bananas. Most bananas are clonally propagated. So we've been thinking about a couple ways that we might be able to attack this problem. We are setting up to engineer a banana with rice XA21 and some of these chimeric variants. So to put those in banana and see if that confers resistance. Banana is a monocot, which is, there are two major classes of flowering plants, monocots and dicots. So banana is more closely related to rice than some other plant species. And we've also begun a chemical biology approach in collaboration with Michelle Arkin at the Small Molecule Discovery Center at UCSF. And the idea is to screen their large library for compounds that disrupt AX21 binding to the RAS-H bacterial receptor. So if we can disrupt binding, that will inhibit biofilm formation and inhibit virulence. So this might be a method that if we can identify a non-toxic, cheap type of molecule that can be sprayed out of the field or used in the tissue culture propagation of banana, it might be a way to control this disease. And eventually, maybe it will be a way to control Stenotrophomonas infections of humans. So these are slides courtesy of Bruce Boiler. And you can see that we have now these very interesting receptors. And one point I would like to make is that mouse has about 12 of these, human 10, flies 1. But look at plants. Arabidopsis is predicted to have 35, and we predicted the number of receptors based on this non-RD motif. So far, there seems to be 100% correlation with the non-RD motif with a role in recognition of conserved microbial signatures, but there may be more, or you know, maybe we got something wrong. But based on this, we estimate there's 35 in Arabidopsis, but look at rice, 328. So rice, maize, and wheat being the most important crops for sustenance, and wheat and maize are also monocots. They also have huge number of receptors. So for those of you interested in innate immunity, if you think there's just too many animal biologists working on this, I encourage you to look at plants. Now, another important project is one collaboration that I've had with Bruce over the years, and I hope we will have many more, but we're very interested in trying to understand and identify the last common ancestors of these receptors. So we use XA21 as the representative receptor of conserved microbial signatures, and TLR4 as a representative receptor of animal receptors. And we're happy that we have identified the last common ancestors. And here they are, Julius Rothstein and Tanny Frank. And I'm very delighted that some in our lineage could be here today. And I thank my parents for making the drive and for being here and being so supportive of this work over the years. So to conclude, I think we've convinced you, I hope, that immune receptors in plants and animals are remarkably similar. And just to recap what I told you specifically about our work, we're very excited about the AS21 protein because it appears to have a dual function. It triggers the immune response, it binds to the XA21 receptor. We're feverishly working to show that AS21 binds the RAS-H receptor. We hope it does. We don't think there's any other examples of a bacterial molecule that binds both the eukaryotic and prokaryotic receptor. We know that the RAS-H-AX21 combination controls biofilm formation, motility, virulence, and other processes. We see AX21 as a new drug target to control deadly groups of bacteria, which there is currently no effective treatments. And we're very interested in these non-RD kinases. We would like to understand why are they so important and how have they been activated. This work, of course, took a team of people to work on. Many of my lab is here today, except for a couple that are off on job interviews. And we have a whole group of people that worked on this. Julian Wong and Wenyuan Song were postdocs in my lab in the 1990s and led the isolation of the XA21 receptor. Several of my postdocs are now professors at Kyunghee University, where we continue to collaborate, and the network work could not have been carried out without the collaboration of Vincent Lee and Edward Markov. So, thank you.